Hello and welcome to a roundup of weird news stories from Odyssey stations across the country, presented by the Something Offbeat podcast. This week we're going up. Up past chairlifts, past auroras, and into space to get the latest on a long-running search for extraterrestrial life. On the way there, we'll also check in on the rare solar storm that impacted Earth this week, as well as people getting stuck on those chairlifts that I mentioned, and a conspiracy theory about gravity. We're going to start off the show with two dispatches out of Odyssey Station KCBS Radio in the Bay Area. First up is Holly Kwan's interview with David Anderson, co-founder of SETI at Home, a crowdsourced project out of UC Berkeley. There, researchers have narrowed down their search for extraterrestrial life to 100 mysterious radio blips from space. Here's more.
SETI at Home is what's called a radio SETI project. We're looking for radio waves coming from space that have a particular property called being narrow band, that their frequency is concentrated around one in a small range instead of being spread over a wide range, which naturally occurring radio waves are. And if you want to find signals like this against the background of noise, you need to do a couple of things. One is you need what's called a radio telescope, which is a big dish. I'm sure you've all seen pictures of these. It's a big dish that collects radio waves coming from a tiny spot on the sky, and it gives you a very powerful kind of microphone. And when we started SETI at Home in 1999, by far the best radio telescope on Earth was the one at Arecibo, which is in Puerto Rico, and we were able to use it for the next 20 years. Now, of course, we didn't use it exclusively. Other projects controlled where it was pointing, but we recorded data continuously. And over those 20 years, the beam of the telescope covered the visible sky many, many times. So SETI at Home is what's called a sky survey. We're looking at big areas of the sky, not individual stars. The second thing you need...
Go ahead.
The second thing that you need to do radio SETI is something called a spectrometer, which takes these radio signals and breaks them up into their different frequencies because you're looking for a narrow band signal. And this is something that's done using computers. And in general, the more computing power you have to do this, the fainter the signals that you can find. So in SETI at Home, we took quite a novel approach. Instead of using a computer sitting at the telescope to do this spectrometry, we distributed the data over the internet to hundreds of thousands of home computers all over the world and used them to do the frequency analysis. So people all over the world downloaded the SETI at Home software on their Macs and PCs and even their Android phones and ran it for many years.
And it worked. I mean, like, these are people who they're not actually having to sit at the computer. It's just doing it.
Yeah, we made it super easy for non-technical people to use. And we devoted a lot of effort to making a website that would explain the science we were doing and teach people something about what radio SETI is. So we did this, and there were kind of three phases to the project. We basically just finished the first two of those. The first phase was simply analyzing all this data using the home computers, and that produced about 12 billion things that we call detections, which are momentary bursts of power at a particular frequency coming from a particular point in the sky. But most or maybe all of these detections are actually due to noise or man-made radio interference. The one problem with radio SETI is that humans produce a lot of radio emissions of all sorts, and these kind of leak into the telescope. So that was the first phase, building up this huge database of detections. The second part, which we finished recently, was writing software to figure out which of these detections are man-made interference. That was kind of tricky, and getting rid of those. And then we also wrote software that goes through the remaining detections and find groups of them that are plausibly signals from space. In other words, they're from about the same place in the sky and about the same frequency.
But it's, it seems like all of the work that you're doing, I mean, it kind of is all pointing to this one goal of trying to find extraterrestrial life. And I know SETI at Home has been ongoing for, 20 years now, but you kind of wonder, like, how much longer, are we going to do this before we find something comprehensive? I know that there are probably comparisons to, like, the Jodie Foster movie Contact, but it's got to be probably more complicated than that. David Anderson is co-founder of SETI at Home. They are looking for other people who want to participate in helping them analyze these radio signals to look for extraterrestrial life.
As the Space Weather Prediction Center released information about the strongest solar storm in decades this week, Tariq Malik, editor-in-chief of space.com, also joined KCBS Radio's Steve Scott to discuss the phenomenon and the aurora spectacle it brought to nearly half of U.S. states.
First off, what is a solar flare in language that a guy who's not like an expert on space and stuff would understand?
Yeah, you know, we might take the sun for granted, Steve, because, you know, it brings us daylight and warmth, but it's a star like any other, and it has its own weather system. It's always active, and on an 11-year basis, it has this weather cycle where it has eruptions from the surface. It's a big ball of gas, basically, and it has these huge eruptions that fling out charged particles in all directions, and sometimes they're aimed at the Earth, and that's what a solar storm actually is. It's those particles that travel out of the sun a million miles an hour. They hit the Earth's atmosphere, and because they're charged, they get funneled to the poles, the magnetic poles of our planet, and they interact with the atmosphere, and that storm is what lights up the atmosphere to create the auroras that we're talking about today.
So tonight's cosmic happening is actually being called, and I think I have this right, an S4 level solar storm. What is the significance of that ranking? Is that a big one? Is that a little one?
Yeah, well, this actually is a really exciting event because it started over the weekend. On about the 18th of January, the sun had this massive eruption. It was an X1 solar flare. That's the most powerful kind of explosion and eruption the sun can have. And it takes a while for it to cross the 90 million miles or so to get to Earth. And that's when it can trigger this geomagnetic storm, this severe S4, G4 level storm. Because normally it's very calm. Maybe you'll get like a G1 or a G2. But when it hits the 3 and 4 stage, that's when the auroras themselves are so active that they can be seen in California. In fact, yesterday we got reports all the way down to New Mexico in the southwestern U.S. It does peter out over time. So if you've got the time to go out and check, that's when you want to, don't wait another night or so because it can fade away fairly quickly.
Not to get too sciencey here, but are these solar flares, are these the things that can like mess up satellite dishes and things like that?
When they're strong enough, it is a big risk. In fact, in the 80s, there was a solar storm, not this strong. It was much, much stronger that actually knocked out the power grid in parts of Canada and New York State, and it caused some shorts. In the 1800s, there was a really massive one called the Carrington event, and that one actually caused, I guess, telegraphs at the time to ignite and light on fire. And so there is always a risk from the radiation, from the charged particles from these storms, to interrupt satellite signals with our our GPS as well as communication satellites. There's a risk to astronauts in space. There's 6 people up there right now, 3 on the International Space Station, 3 on China's space station. They have to be very mindful of this environment because if the radiation is severe enough, they might have to leave and come back to Earth. It doesn't seem like it's that strong of a storm, but there's always that risk that you want to track and know when they're going to happen.
So the Northern Lights might be visible as far south as California?
Well, they were yesterday, and it seems like it might be ebbing out right now. Like the latest forecast as of the time that we're speaking has about 10 states in the cross hours that could be visible, and that's anything along the northern edge of the United States. So you've got Alaska, North Dakota, Maine. Now, North Dakota and Minnesota, Montana, they sound like they're high up, but those areas usually do not see auroras. It's usually mostly kind of parts of Canada. So if things change, because it seems like it's a very active situation right now, it could fluctuate down towards that the northernmost bits of California there. Right now, it does seem to be easing up, but there's always a chance for the next storm because the sun is in a pretty active period right now.
You know, I always thought that if you wanted to see the aurora borealis, you had to go to, I don't know, Iceland or Norway or Alaska or somewhere like that. Does it seem like it's creeping farther south all of a sudden?
Well, like I mentioned, the sun has an 11-year cycle. So that has a peak, just like our own year, you know, where like it's nice and the weather is nice and clear in the summer. And then in the winter, it gets very, very stormy. The sun has that kind of cycle, too. And it lasts about 11 years. And at the maximum, which we just came out of about a year or two ago, that's when you would expect a lot of activity. But we are on the downslide from that. However, scientists have been saying that this downslide does not mean that there's like a drop off in activity. We've actually been seeing more larger and intense storms because of that, and then it'll creep on back down to a minimum. Then the whole cycle will start over again. So this is kind of like the sweet spot for aurora hunters to see. I actually had the opportunity a year or so ago to see auroras in Alaska on a cruise, and it was something that I'd never seen before with my own eyes. You know, we just see these amazing pictures that usually come in from our readers. And even though it was really dim at that point, we had just missed a massive solar storm like what we're seeing now, it was still very impressive and really exciting. And one thing that your listeners might want to know is that even if you can't see it, your phone might be able to. If you leave it on a long exposure and point it at the sky, sometimes it can pick up auroras that you can't see with your own eyes because of the sensitivity of your phone's camera. That happened to me, and I was so excited when I saw the images later.
Does climate change change the way we see the aurora?
Well, our ability to see the aurora is really weather dependent. So in that sense, then yes, if you're in an area that is getting a lot more storms and a lot more cloud cover because of climate change, that can impact what you're able to see. A few years ago, there was this massive solar storm that lasted for like 3 days, and we had people that could see them as far south as Mexico. And I live in New Jersey, and it rained for 5 days straight. We didn't see anything at all. And so from that kind of perspective, that's a limitation that can affect your ability to observe it. But the actual, like, the source of these storms is from the sun itself, so not really affected by climate change.
Do we need to be concerned about radiation that solar flares give off?
They can, like, the strongest of these events can cause extreme radiation events. In fact, this storm we learned today was the strongest radiation storm from a solar event since 2003. There was this huge series of storms. They called them the Halloween solar storms of 2003. And this is the strongest that we've seen since then. Now, the people that are the most susceptible are, as I mentioned, the astronauts that are in space at the time, because there's not as much protection from Earth's atmosphere, which does a lot of the screening for us on the surface. And there's not as much protection for their gear and whatnot. We are seeing that, you know, there can be an increase in that exposure for people that fly a lot too in the upper atmosphere during those storms. So it is something that people are researching now because of the activity that we're seeing from the sun.
Calm. Is it okay to look at a solar flare? I mean, you know, we're taught don't look at an eclipse. I mean, the brightness or the energy of a solar flare, of the aurora, I should say. Is it okay to look at that?
Well, the great thing about the aurora is, just like a lunar eclipse, is that it's at night. That's the only time that you can really see it. So it is safe to look at it because it's nighttime. It's not so bright. And this actually is really important for folks to keep in mind. Just because you might live on a dark street doesn't mean that you can, you know, even if it's right overhead, that you can look up and see the auroras. You need like the darkest skies that you can find, way away from city lights. I live in the suburbs outside of New York City, and even though we only have one street light, even that one street light is too much to see, or the glow from the cities nearby. So you want to be kind of out as far away as you can get from city lights, and then you're going to need some time to adjust. But it is very safe. And what I find very interesting is that the different colors, we all are used to the green of the auroras, but people from the images that we've been seeing over the last few days are seeing purples and blues. It's absolutely spectacular.
If you missed the aurora, there will be more chances to see similar spectacles in the future. Also, stay tuned to learn more about this conspiracy theory concerning gravity here on Earth, and what you might not know about getting stuck on a chairlift. You're listening to a special presentation of Weird News Roundups from Odyssey's Something Offbeat. What do you think would happen if Earth suddenly didn't have gravity for just a few seconds? Would that be enough to cause Final Destination-style chaos across the globe? Thankfully, that's a question that belongs safely in the realm of science fiction, according to NASA. However, there are some people who believe that August 12th, that's the day of an upcoming solar eclipse, will also come with a brief loss of gravity. NASA officials had to step in and debunk this theory recently. The Dave Glover Show out of KMOX in St. Louis recently discussed this bizarre conspiracy theory. Here's their talk.
There is a conspiracy theory claiming that Earth will lose gravity for 7 seconds on August 12th.
Oh, for God's sake.
So this secret was revealed allegedly.
Man, I hope they're right.
It's a NASA document titled Project Anchor, and this was leaked all the way back in November of 2024, so we have had plenty of time to prepare for this. And they're saying there could be at least 40 million deaths from falls alone, because, you know, we're not going to have gravity for 7 seconds.
So that means you're going to rise for 7 seconds and then fall.
That's how I took it, yes. Now, NASA says we don't have anything to worry about.
What do they know?
Yeah.
They say
the
only way for the Earth to lose gravity would be for the Earth system, the combined mass of its core, mantle, crust, ocean, terrestrial water, and atmosphere, to lose mass. But the conspiracy theorists say NASA is wrong. NASA knows about it. They won't tell us the truth. So everyone just kind of get ready for August 12th, is what they're saying.
How does anyone believe that gravity can just go away?
For 7 seconds.
At all!
Well, it's going to be a total eclipse of the sun passing over the Arctic Ocean. So that's going to make gravity disappear.
So it'll change the density of the Earth in its rotation. And for only 7 seconds, though.
Yeah.
And then it'll go right back.
And then it's
back.
Like, oh, we're back.
Seriously, there are people that will believe anything. Anything.
So let's say that they said it was going to be 2:13 p.m. on August 12th, again, Trisha's birthday. Of course,
and Kurt's birthday.
It's going to happen on Trisha's birthday. We're going to all float. But let's say it was 2:13 p.m. At 2:13 p.m., are you standing close to something that's fastened down and holding on?
Oh, I'm just going to get in my car and buckle my seatbelt.
Gravity's going nowhere. God almighty, man.
I'm just going to hug a tree, I guess.
Just run real fast and wait to lift off.
And also, if gravity disappeared for 7 seconds, a lot more than 40 million people would die.
You'd think.
I mean, it would be billions of people dying.
All of our stuff would get messed up.
Everything would be, everything.
Everything's going to spill.
Everything. What do you think? I can't even. The sheer level of stupid in the world right now is intolerable. It is intolerable.
You need this today to distract you.
I do. Yeah. I need some good old anger to get me straight
through
to 6:30.
You have been thinking about Miami for the past few minutes.
It's like, God bless America, man. How many times I almost swore in just the last 10 seconds?
It's real close to Idiocracy. It's real close.
Honest to God, I don't know how many people believe it. I believe there are so many people that push it knowing those things are just wrong. Because they can mess with people. It's just a nonstop troll job.
Scott says, please bring it.
I mean, at this point.
Yeah, let's see what happens. Yeah, I don't care. What do I have to lose?
The idea. What did they say? They said 40 million lives?
Yeah. Just from falling.
If the whole Earth loses gravity at the same time, which is the only way it could happen, right?
Right.
Billions of people are going to die. Because a lot of people are not going to know.
Right.
Because NASA's hiding it from them.
Sure.
Well, half of them will be in bed.
And the whole world. Like, you know, NASA's the only place that can study these things. Nobody else studies anything. There are no space agencies in any other countries.
Just get weighted blankets. because they'll keep their density. The Earth's going to lose its density. A weighted blanket will be A-okay.
So am I thinking this is like, if as long as you're indoors, you're fine because you'll just float to the ceiling?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like
for
Willy
7 seconds.
Just don't go outside and then
turn off the fan
so just
first.
Line all of the rooms in your workplace and your house with mattresses so that when you fall, you'll land on something soft.
God. Tell you what, I'm taking that day off. I'm not floating around for 7 seconds with you people.
You're going to miss the opportunity to broadcast in zero gravity.
Speaking of floating around in the air, our last story is about the very real possibility of getting stuck or even falling off a chairlift when you go skiing or snowboarding. Dozens of people recently faced this chilling and chilly reality when they got stuck on the lift for 5 hours. Adam and Jordana out of WCCO News Talk in the Twin Cities discussed the harrowing tale this week.
Absolutely. So stunned by this. It's that story in the news about those people who got caught on a chairlift.
I thought of Dave Josephson right away.
Immediately I did too, because that's David's dream. To be up in the sky.
I'm dressed for it. I love it up here. I'll stay up.
Proper clothing choices. You know, and then I mentioned this to David before the show, and he talked to me about how people are rescued from the chairlift. I am, for me, if I was stuck in a chairlift, I would have to tell them, just let me die here. That would be the end of it. I would just, I would end it all, because I don't know that I could stomach the rescue. David will detail, he will detail how the rescue went. How do more people not fall out of this thing? Okay, so David, people got stuck on a chairlift at Lutzen. Now, I know this was last weekend, so maybe it wasn't as cold as our current temperatures, because that would have been super brutal.
I think it was close, though, because it was the wind that was, like, winds were blowing like over 50 miles an hour.
And David says to me, George, do you know how they rescue people from the chairlift? Now, I, again, came to snowboarding late in life. I learned at age 40 for my husband and, you know, our kids. We taught our kids. And it's been a great activity for our family. So I appreciate it. But it doesn't mean that every time I get on the chairlift, and certainly when we're high or if there's, you know, if it's a really extreme lift, I don't freak out a little bit thinking I could so easily fall out of this thing.
When you are high, you do feel that way.
You know what I mean. Physically. Well, you know what I mean.
Yeah.
So it scares me a little bit every single time, getting on, getting off.
Especially when it goes to the real high points.
It goes over the bumps.
When it stops.
I get a little bit nervous thinking how easy it would be and how do more people not fall out of this thing? And then, you know, at some point it stops because somebody has fallen off at the beginning or they've, you know, there's been some kind of a pile. When people aren't getting off properly or they fall, it happens. It's happened to all of us. So it freaks me out a little bit. And David goes, George, do you know how they rescue those people? And I stupidly said, no, how? And then he told me. And then I thought, so now I know if this ever does happen to me, I will just be entombed on the chairlift forever because I will never be rescued. So go ahead, David. I was hoping they would send a helicopter for me, but he says that's not the way.
Oh, I'd be way too dangerous to have a helicopter up there. Are you kidding me? And those winds and everything? I was at a local ski resort one night when one of the lifts broke down, and we were not on the lift, but we were skiing other runs. We're like, wow, that lift's been, you know, stopped for, you know, one run, two runs, three runs. So the people were stuck up there for half hour, 45 minutes, and then you see they are not able to fix it. So they send out their team of ski patrol to manually evacuate the chairlift, which means they have a rope that on one end has a disc, and it would be like something that'd be on like a playground, right? Yeah. Where you like sit with the rope between your legs and the disc underneath and you can swing back and forth. It's got one of those on the end. So they throw that up over the cable that holds the chairlift. And then slide that over to where you are on the chair, and you drop your skis and snowboard. Mm-hmm. And then they've got like one of those cushion pillows below you just in case something happens. But then you put that between your legs, sit on that little disc, hold on to the rope, and slowly inch your way off the chair until you're dangling in the air, and they slowly
lower you down,
confidently lower you down to the ground. And they went right up and down. They had one team that started at the top of the lift, one team at the bottom. They met in the middle, and they, like, more quickly than you'd think, they evacuated that entire chairlift.
Yeah. And people were willing to slide their tushies onto the little disc.
I mean,
with the wind blowing, and it's just like you and a disc. There's nothing between you and the.
Your other option is to stay up there indefinitely.
Yeah, late, and this, we're talking about this case of Lutzen.
Darker and windier.
The guy who filmed that, they were the last one. They said, because they were dressed warmly enough, they said, go ahead and get everybody else. We'll be the last. That's they were nice. Up there for 5 hours.
That's insanity. That's
and they kept skiing after.
Insanity. I would be frozen to death. Again, I would not survive in the wild very long, my friends. This is why I would say, just leave me here. I don't think I could handle it. And then once they brought out, what, like the giant net, like the fireman's net, just in case you slip off the disc, oh, that would put me under. I would freeze. I'd freeze to death. And I would wish for death. I just couldn't do it.
That would be brutal, though. Like even an hour, you'd be like, oh, my gosh, what are we doing here?
And I think that I would never do it again. You know, I mean, again, I would be dead.
You mean?
I would be dead.
Yeah.
But so I wouldn't have the opportunity. But if that experience happens, does it happen a lot?
No. I think it happens very infrequently because we're hearing about the one time this year that happened in Minnesota. And there are a dozen ski resorts in Minnesota.
Yeah.
Many more in Wisconsin and Michigan. And, you know, of all those ski resorts, this is, you know, probably the one or maybe two times that that's going to happen. And those lifts are running all day, every day for 4 months. So
what
it's
about
very
people
rare.
Falling off? Has anybody ever witnessed that? Somebody?
Well, my kid, Morgan, I took her to Afton Alps when we went for ski lessons one day. And she spent the first 2 hours in ski lessons. And then she got done. I said, okay, let's try a run. And we got on the ski lift. And as soon as it took off, she slipped off, and I had her by her hands, and she was hanging there.
No.
And they stopped. I mean, we were only 10 feet off the ground. But
then what happened?
I pulled her back up on the seat, and we went down, and she's like, that's it for me. I'm done.
Yeah. Has she ever skied again?
She's never been skiing since.
I don't blame her one second. Oh, my gosh. That's absolutely terrifying.
Thank you all for listening to this roundup of weird news presented by Odyssey's Something Offbeat podcast. This episode was written and produced by me, Lauren Berry. Special thanks to KCBS Radio in the Bay Area, The Dave Glover Show out of KMOX in St. Louis, and The Adam and Jordana Show out of WCCO News Talk in the Twin Cities. You can find these stations and shows, as well as these weird news roundups, on the Odyssey app or wherever you find your podcasts.